When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello everyone and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today I'm delighted to talk to Sheikh Hamza Karamali. You're most welcome again, sir.
Thank you for having me again, Paul. It's a pleasure to be with you.
A pleasure to have you. Now, for those who don't know, Hamza is the founder of Basira Education, where he trains parents, teachers and scholars in high schools, weekend religious schools and a variety of other educational institutions how to show their students why Islam is true. He's developed a textbook, an online teachers portal, and is on a mission to train 10,000 teachers. And I'll link to his work in the description below. Hamza will be speaking today about Abu Hanifa, who was a Muslim theologian, jurist, who became the eponymous founder of the Hanafi school of Sunni jurisprudence, which has remained the most widely practiced school of law in the Muslim world.
Yeah.
And it's reported, actually, that he personally met a number of the Sahaba. These are the actual companions of the Prophet, including Anas ibn Malik. So he's an incredibly early and significant figure in Muslim history. And he's famous for authoring this book, the Kitab al-Athar of Imam Abu Hanifa. Obviously, this is the English translated, huge, great big wedge, a brick of a book. And it is actually the first book of Islam after the time of the companions. So it's a really important work. It's basically full of hadith. And it's reading it earlier on again, and it's really interesting, actually, even today. Sheikh Hamza, could you perhaps, who was Imam Abu Hanifa, and why is he so important?
So, as you said, the reason why he's normally held to be important is because he's the founder of one of the four schools of Sunni Islamic law or jurisprudence. But I think there's another reason, and that reason is why he's one of my favorite scholars. And that reason is that he was a publicly revered scholar. People respected him, people looked up to him, and he commanded public opinion to such a degree that caliphs sought out his approval. He refused to give it to them. He was a person of integrity, and he was an independent scholar. He didn't have any outside influence, and he took a number of dangerous public stands during his lifetime. Because of that, he won the love of the Muslim masses. And I think that that these events that took place around him, they capture something that's very surprising but very special about early Islamic civilization that we should know about much more.
Wow. And he wasn't an Arab, was he? I must have been an Arab, but he wasn't, was he?
That's right, he wasn't. And he actually, most scholars before his time, just shortly before his time, they weren't Arab, and that comes as a surprise. I have this snippet. It's a famous conversation that took place between one of the caliphs and one of the scholars of the time.
A caliph was the Muslim ruler. So he wasn't just like the Pope, like a spiritual figurehead type guy. He was an actual ruler who had political and military power. So to speak to him was really important. It wasn't just some kind of figurehead.
Yeah, and this difference between a caliph and a pope is, I think, it's something that's really important that'll come out in today's conversation. So there's one of the Umayyad caliphs. There was a scholar. He came to him. His name was Atta. He asked him. Oh, and so the scholars, they used to be in the courts of the caliphs. There was positive to it. There's a negative to it. We're going to look at the positive and the reason why that happened. It comes out in the story of Abu Hanifa. We'll get to that in a second. But the important thing here is that he asked Atta. He says, "Oh Atta, do you have any knowledge of the leading scholars of the Muslim centers, the Muslim cities at this time?" So that there was Medina, there was Mecca, there was Damascus. There was Kufa. There's all of these other all of these cities, and each city had a prominent scholar who was most respected by the people in that city. So he said, "Yes, I do." So he said, "Who is the leading scholar, the leading faqih of the people of Medina?" He said, "Nafir, the freed slave of Ibn Umar." Abdullah ibn Umar is the son of Umar ibn Khattab, and so he had I like to say quote unquote slave, because I think one of the things that comes out from here is that as an institution, slavery was very different in this time than we're used to hearing. So he's, there's Nafir. He's one of the main teachers of Imam Malik. And he was captured in a war, and he served the son of Umar al-Khattab. He became Muslim. He was freed, and he became the leading religious authority of the city of Medina. And he wasn't, and so he says here, the caliph says, he didn't ask, but it's obvious he's not an Arab. And the Arabs, they came to him, they sat at his feet, they learned from him. Then he said, "What about of Mecca?" And then he said that there's another scholar, his name is Atta ibn Abi Rabah. He said, "Is he an Arab or is he a Mawla?" Mawla is normally a freed slave, could have a slightly different relationship as well. So he said, "He's a Mawla. He's a normally a freed slave." He said, "What about the people of Yemen?" And he mentioned somebody called Tawus, and he asked him again, "Is he Arabian or is he a Mawla?" He said, "He's a Mawla." He said, "What about the people of Yamama?" This is like central Arabia. He said, "Yahya ibn Abi Kathir, is he a Mawla or is he an Arabian?" He says, "A Mawla." He said, "What about the people of Damascus?" He said, "Makrut." He said, is he a Mawla, non-Arabian former slave, or an Arabian? He said, "He's a Mawla." He said, "What about the people of Iraq in between the Tigris and the Euphrates, Mesopotamia?" He said, "Mahmud ibn Mehran." He said, "Is he a Mawla or is he an Arabian?" He said, he's a Mawla. He said, "What about the people of Persia?" He mentioned somebody else who's also a Mawla. He asked about him. He said, "What about the people of Basra?" He said, "Hassan al-Basri, famous Tabi'i, he's also a Mawla. And he's the son of slaves of the wives of the Prophet, mm-hmm. and Ibn Sirin." And then he said, what about the people of Kufa, who we're going to look at today? And he mentioned that their main scholar is Ibrahim al-Nakhai, who is in the chain of teachers of Abu Hanifa. And he asked him, is he a Mawla or an Arabian? He said, no, he's an Arabian. So he said, I thought that you would, you know, that there wouldn't be any Arabians left. So what happened was that some recent writers, they've described this phenomenon in a very nice way. They said that the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and his companions, they weren't people of civilization. They were Bedouins and came from a predominantly illiterate society, but the Prophet ﷺ taught them and they made.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Civilization. They made a civilization. It was very literate, but through the interaction that happened between the Arabians and the Persians in particular, Imam Abu Hanifa is a Persian. They came into the Muslim lands. They studied with the companions, and because they are a literate, so these quote unquote slaves, many of them they were highly learned, educated people. And so when they became Muslim, this way of analytic thinking systematic organization, definitions, analysis, which they're used to, it came into the Muslim world. And many of the Islamic sciences, the leading scholars are all for this reason. They weren't Arabian. They weren't Arabs. Sibawayh, the founder of Arabic grammar, he's a Persian. He learned it wasn't his native tongue. It's famous. He wanted to study hadith, and so he went and he recited a hadith, and he made a mistake in a vowel, and it seems like the teacher was maybe a little bit bad tempered, so he got upset at him, and he said he made a grammatical mistake in the hadith of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So he swore an oath. He said, I'm going to learn a science because of which nobody will ever say I made a grammatical mistake again. Wow. And he became Sibawayh. Sibawayh is like, he's really big in Arabic grammar and grammar in general. There's no grammar anywhere in the world. Muslims are the first people who invented grammar. So to come back to your question, yes, Abu Hanifa was not an Arab. And he was
a Persian from what was today Iran, obviously.
He was the Persian civilization, it was a... It was one of the superpowers of the time, and it came to an abrupt end because of the Muslims. It came to an end in the time of the companions. So the Persians, their lands were far beyond Iran, and Persian influential people, they were in the neighboring lands. So he was from a city, from Kabul, present day Afghanistan. But he's Persian, and his grandfather and father, they were Persian, and they came and they settled in a city called Kufa. Kufa was built in the time of Umar ibn al-Khattab, and it was built out of nothing. So it was just after the Muslims had won the Battle of Qadisiyah, they'd taken Ctesiphon, and the Persian Empire basically came, there was their capital. So because Persia was so far away and the Muslim armies, they departed from Medina, they needed a base that was closer to Persia. So they looked around, the companions, they didn't like to swim. They were scared of water. So there you had this Tigris and Euphrates. So he tried to keep them on this side of the water, but as close as possible to Persia and Mesopotamia. So they chose this place, Kufa, and they made a city. Initially, it was tents, then grew into a permanent settlement. And he wanted, Sayyidina Umar, he wanted to keep these Arabian armies away from the Persians because he didn't want them to get used to luxury and lose their ruggedness. But it grew into, it became an economic center, administrative center. So that's why it overtook. There were two centers in the early time of the companions. There was the religious center in Medina, but then Kufa, it became the financial, military, decision-making place. That's why in the time of the fourth caliph, Ali, he moved the capital from Medina to Kufa. And many companions, they went there. So Abu Hanifa's father, his name is Thabit. Abu Hanifa's name is Norman. His father's name is Thabit. And when his father, as a child, was taken to Sayyidina Ali, the Caliph Ali, and it said that he prayed for him, and he made... So Kufa was full of companions, and many, many companions came there, and there was full of learning. And it's where the two schools of Arabic grammar, they originated in Kufa and Basra, which was close by. So he was born there. Abu Hanifa was born in the city of Kufa to a wealthy and influential Persian family. They were cloth merchants, so that's where
So is it true that he would have met at some point in his life? The reports were that he actually met some of the companions themselves. These are actual people who knew the Prophet, had seen the Prophet, who died upon Islam. He actually knew them or met them at least?
When he was young. So they used to have, the scholars of hadith, they have conditions for narrating hadith, and they differ. So if there's some hadith that are narrated by companions who are children, so Abdullah ibn Abbas, there's a famous hadith, the Prophet ﷺ had him sitting behind him on a camel, and he said to him, "Oh, little boy, I'm going to teach you some words to remember them, and you know, be conscious of Allah will take care of you." So famous hadith, but the point here is that he's a young boy. And so there's many hadith that are narrated by companions, and they heard them when they were young children, 8, 9, 10 years old. Anas ibn Malik, one of them. So they did that. But in the succeeding generations, when somebody would come and say that I heard the Prophet say this, then in the next generation, the scholars of hadith, they differed regarding how old somebody needs to be in order for them to be able to narrate. Because now it's an abstract thing. In the lives of the companions, it's physical, you remember, and it's the most important person in existence.
Yeah, but Abu Hanifa wasn't just some ordinary child. He was an exceptionally gifted and talented person. So he could well have understood and appreciated what was happening when he met these eminent personages, the companions of the Prophet. I'm just saying he's not like just some random child. Yeah. He's a formidable mind.
Yeah, so it was he met some of the companions towards the end of their lives, but he didn't narrate hadith from them for this reason, because the people of Kufa, they said you have to be 20 years old order for you. You have to hear something when you're 20 years old in order to be able to narrate it to the next generation. So in terms of hadith, his hadith narrations come from people, not companions, and mostly from not the followers, but the next generation. But he met companions. Anas ibn Malik, one of them, as a child.
That dates him. It dates him almost at the beginning of Islam, basically. The generation afterwards, which is incredibly early.
Yeah. Very early. Yeah, he's the earliest of the four imams.
Of course, just for those who don't appreciate, I mean, there were no four schools then of jurisprudence. It simply didn't exist. There wasn't even the Hanafi school early on. So this is before all the Sunni jurisprudence had been developed, usul had happened. It was simply extraordinary individuals like Abu Hanifa making their ruling, doing their rulings and so on. So this really predates what we later understand as the developed Sunni Islam.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Gosh. So how influential exactly was Abu Hanifa in his time? I mean, how much of a leader was he?
So he's, I think what used to happen, and it still happens to some degree, but it used to happen more, is that if somebody is a religious scholar and religion is important to the lives of people around them, then they are naturally going to be in a position of leadership, because if they say that, you know, just to take like an extreme example, if they were to say that nobody listened to the ruler, so Abu Hanifa didn't do that, of course, but if they were to say that, then they would wield influence. People would listen to them, and they wouldn't listen to the caliph, because the caliph is not like the pope. The caliph is not he doesn't represent the religion. His role, they had executive roles, but the law that they ruled by, that law was.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Has developed through a process of scholarly reasoning by the major religious authorities of the time, who were independent scholars, and they had the support of the people. And so the caliph, in order for him to rule successfully, he had to rule by that law. Otherwise, people wouldn't want him in place.
So as Islamic ruler, just to clarify, he didn't make up laws like a modern ruler might do and say, I as the ruler would want this law and that law. He followed the law that was established and codified by independent scholars. This is the Sharia, of course. It wasn't some other law. So it was based on revelation. It's based on the Quran, based on the Sunnah, which includes Hadith and so on and so on.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think a better contrast would be in the medieval period in Christian lands, where the king, you had the rule of kings, like you explained, and so there was no rule of kings, so they weren't absolutist. They didn't say that
the divine right, the divine right of kings, like Charles Charles II. Interesting, I should mention Charles II today. Charles I, his father, very much believed in the divine right of kings, and it actually triggered a civil war in England, and he ended up having his head chopped off because he was so intransigent and arrogant, and he stood on his authority as divine king. You know, I'm appointed by God, you can't touch me. But that's not what the caliph was like. You're saying the caliph isn't a divinely appointed caliph. He is a successor to the prophet himself and is accountable in some way to others, or to the law anyway, to the Sharia. Is that right?
So theoretically, they were supposed to be elected by influential people. So by the time of Abu Hanifa, that election process, which happened in the time of the companions, but after that, it turned into a dynasty, and there was hereditary succession. So, but there was still a certain kind of people would install them into the representatives of the people who used to install them into government would be prominent religious scholars, because these were the people who were seen by the caliphs to be to represent public will, and it was like that. And so this created a relationship, unavoidable relationship between the caliph and the scholars, particularly the scholars of Sharia, like Abu Hanifa, because if the caliph can get some scholars in his pocket, then he can rule very conveniently and with great power and great effectiveness. So there's a constant move throughout this period of caliphs to try and do that. And many scholars did end up going into their pockets, but they didn't. People recognized that. And so the scholars who became influential, who wrote books, who were studied, whose works were studied, these were always, or predominantly, we'll talk about Abu Hanifa's student, but they were predominantly independent scholars. So Abu Hanifa, for this reason, he's very influential. So Abu Hanifa, he is the preeminent scholar of Kufa, the student of the preeminent scholar named Hammad. And Kufa is an important administrative, military, economic center. So people, they all go to him. So when there was there were several incidents like this. The most famous of them is just after the Abbasid revolution. So Abu Hanifa straddled the Umayyads and the Abbasids. And there was the Abbasid revolution was very bloody. The first ruler, his title is As-Safah, which means the shedder of blood. And he probably took that title to strike fear into the hearts of people. So he didn't rule for that long. After him, he had his successor. His successor is Abu Ja'far al-Mansur. And there's a famous series of events that took place between Abu Hanifa and Abu Ja'far al-Mansur. So Abu Ja'far, he wanted Abu Hanifa to be the chief judge. So this idea of chief judge is something that's a later invention. It's not there in the time of the companions, but it's like chief judge means that you are, it's like the Supreme Court. So you have judges and then you can appeal to the highest level. So the highest level is the chief judge. So Abu Hanifa, he refused. And there's many stories that are told, they're related through different chains of transmission. One of the famous ones, it shows his wit, is he apologized, said, "I'm not qualified to be a judge." And Abu Ja'far al-Mansur got enraged. He said, "You're lying. How can Abu Hanifa not be qualified?" And so he said, "Well, if I'm lying, then I'm not qualified, because a liar isn't qualified to be a judge."
Checkmate.
Yeah. So he wasn't happy. He also, there's another event where so in this, it was a turbulent time. So there's been a revolution and you're trying to make sure that people listen to you. And there's armies that will execute and do all kinds of things to make sure that people listen to the ruler. So he made a treaty with an agreement, a verbal agreement with a particular city, Abu Ja'far al-Mansur. And he said that if you rebel, then you agree that I can kill all of you. And so they rebelled. And so he called a number of scholars to his court. And so now you can understand what the scholars are doing in the court. It's a two-way thing. So on one side, it's that the ruler, you know, wants to kind of influence them and show people that they're on his side. But on the other side, it's because religion is important, and the ruler knows that in order for he can't make law. So in order for his decisions to be obeyed by people, he needs to have approval of the scholars. People don't see him as a scholar. He's not seen as a pope.
No, people
are not going to. So there was other scholars who said that, well, that's what they agreed to. And so, you know, go ahead and do what you want. And Abu Hanifa is, and there's a hadith of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam where he said that Muslims should keep their conditions. Al-Muslimuna ala shurutihim. And so Abu Hanifa, he said, this is one of his brave stances, he said that when they said that, they gave you authority to do something that you can never have authority to do, because you can't just go around killing people without reason. There's only very well-defined reasons for execution, very few high standards of proof. Everybody, he told everybody to go, and then he listened to Abu Hanifa. But he tried to make him chief judge, and Abu Hanifa refused. And so to him, this was an affront, because now Abu Hanifa, when he's refusing to be the judge, and everybody knows, you know, Abu Hanifa has refused to be.
You know, he's not under control. He's just out there being independently minded, which is shocking.
Yeah, but also if people find out, and people did find out, then it's like a rebuff.
He defied the caliph. He defied him and said no.
Or the caliph, he doesn't approve of the caliph. Abu Hanifa doesn't approve of the caliph.
Yes, so it depends on the reasons why he said no. But yeah, the implication could be that he doesn't approve of the ruler. Yeah.
It wasn't explicit. Yeah, he didn't explicitly say that. But people will talk, and so it doesn't look good anyway. So he was imprisoned. He was beaten severely, and he refused to become. And that was, some biographers say, it was the cause of his death. And this happened more than once. Abu Hanifa, he did this with another ruler before him as well. What this shows is that this eponymous founder of the Hanafi school, who's revered by the Muslims, there's no institutionalized church that's been bought out by a king. But it's independent people, not even an Arabian people. There's some reports that says that Abu Hanifa's ancestors were slaves, but others, his grandson said they weren't. But even if he were, just the way that early Islamic civilization, knowledge-based, Sharia-based civilization worked, it wouldn't have been. Wouldn't have been a blemish on his, wouldn't tarnish his thing. He's influential. So this, it says something about how Islamic law, Sharia, it was developed, and it's one of the reasons why I.
I think it's important to compare what was going on in Europe during this time of the life of Abu Hanifa. And historians have called this time the Dark Ages. This is the early medieval period, the Dark Ages in Europe. And with good reason. After the fall of the Western Roman Empire, it was a time marked by great economic and intellectual and cultural decline. So the West is really going into is going to a very dark area at this time when Islam is flourishing intellectually and in every other way. But there were one or two interesting points, nonetheless. Almost at the same time as Abu Hanifa in 773 AD, to use the Western calendar, there was King Offa of Mercia. Now, he was an early English king. Talking a lot about English kings at the moment, trying not to reference the obvious what's going on in the world. But anyway, he minted a coin that imitated a dinar. Now, dinar was the main coin of the Islamic Empire at that time, medieval Islamic empires. They were called dinars. And the interesting thing about this coin, which I've seen, it exists in London, it bears the Shahada. Now, this is the Islamic declaration of faith. So an English royal coin in gold, is made of gold, actually says that there is no God but God, and Muhammad is the prophet of God. And it's on display at the British Museum, and it's extraordinary. But why did he do this? I think the center of gravity at that time was so much in the Muslim world, commercially, culturally, economically, especially, that the English monarch felt that it was a good idea to produce gold coinage that would be usable in the Mediterranean area. But the coinage actually had the Shahada on it. And you can just Google it, King Offa, O-F-F-A, coin, and you can see pictures of it online. And it's most remarkable that English royal coinage had the Islamic creed, the Islamic declaration of faith. So this is at the time of Abu Hanifa, the very end of his life, by the way.
And I'm sure people are saying, you know, like, we should be like the Muslims. We should be free like the Muslims. We should have economic freedoms like the Muslims. We should have the freedom to speak up to the government like the Muslims do. We should have all, and that's where all of their, their Islamic prosperity and economic progress and scientific progress, it came from, that's where it came from. It was a very different time.
It was a very different time, yes. That's a different story. But how did Abu Hanifa make a living exactly? And what was his day job, if he had one?
Yeah, so Abu Hanifa, he came from a family of cloth merchants. And at this time, this is pre-industrial revolution, cloth is a very expensive commodity. So in the fiqh books that were written in the time of Abu Hanifa, they actually had a section that described what you should do if you don't, how to pray if you don't have any clothes to wear. So, which means that this would happen because people would only have one set of clothes. Maybe they're being washed, and clothing is expensive. It's a very expensive thing.
Handmade, I suppose. Yeah.
He sold luxury goods, and which means that he was a very wealthy man. And he used to, so that means he didn't need anybody. In fact, he used to support other people, other scholars. And one of his most prominent students, his name is Abu Yusuf. And Abu Yusuf, he goes on to become the chief judge. Not like Abu Hanifa refused. Abu Yusuf accepted for a reason. We'll talk about that. He goes on to become the chief judge of Harun al-Rashid. But he, during the time of Abu Hanifa, was poor. So he would come to the sessions of Abu Hanifa. He wanted to learn religious knowledge. And his father would say to him that Abu Hanifa is a well-to-do man. But if you go and you study and you don't earn a living, then you won't, how will you make your ends meet? And so he didn't show up for a couple of times. Then he came back and Imam Abu Hanifa asked about him. This is another great thing about Imam Abu Hanifa, how he was as a teacher. So he asked about him and he said, and he found out that he had financial troubles. He said, I'll take care of you. And so he gave him a sack of coins. He says, when it runs out, then tell me. But Abu Yusuf said that before it ever ran out, somehow he would find out and he would just replenish it. And he went on and he became one of the greatest scholars of his time. And so all of that is done, just as in one of the greatest acts of charity of Abu Hanifa. Abu Hanifa had a very interesting way of teaching. So he used to teach in the mosque, in the Grand Mosque of Kufa. So at that time, the mosques, they used to be bubbling with learning and religious activity. So his story of how he became a scholar is that he was just a cloth merchant. And there was a famous hadith scholar, his name is Ash-Shaabi. He saw Abu Hanifa, spoke to him, got to know him, and he was passing by and he asked him, which people do you visit? And Imam Abu Hanifa, he said that I visit so-and-so. He mentioned some cloth merchants. He said, I'm not talking about business. I'm talking about religious scholars. Who do you visit? He said, well, I don't visit that many. He said, you should. And, a man of your intelligence your intelligence should study. And this is what intelligent people at this time did. And so he said sometimes people say something, it influences you. So it influenced him and he turned to learning. And he went through, he studied various things. Eventually he had his teacher, Hamad, who was Imam Abu Hanifa, he studied with like 4,000 teachers. That doesn't mean that he studied with them a lot, maybe just sat with them once or something. But he had many, many different people he learned from. But the person he learned from the most was Hamad. He studied with him for 18 years. And he used to teach in the Mosque of Kufa. So Abu Hanifa used to teach in the Mosque of Kufa. And he had a circle, and people would come, and they narrate, they tell that when the way that he would teach is that there would be an issue that would be an issue of Sharia, of sacred law, that would be put out for discussion, and there would be scholars in attendance, and somebody would say, well, I think it should be like this, and somebody else would say, no, I think it should be like this, and voices would rise and there would be debate and everything, and everybody would have a chance. And at the end, when his turn came, he would give his own opinion after listening to everybody else's, and everybody would listen to him and then record what he had said. So it's a very hands-off kind of teaching style, and encouraging people to think and come to their own conclusions. And many of his students, even after they heard him, they disagreed with him. And that was to be expected. So yeah. In Hanafi school, in books of Hanafi fiqh, they talk about the Imam, which is Abu Hanifa, and they talk about the Sahibain, the two companions of Abu Hanifa. These are Abu Yusuf and Muhammad ibn Hassan al-Shaybani. Yeah. And they frequently disagree. So when you study Hanafi fiqh, you study, this is what Imam Abu Hanifa says, and this is what he says, and this is what he says, and this is the reasoning for this, and this is the reasoning for this.
I can confirm this is the case. This is the first book of Islam after the companions, the Kitab al-Athar by Abu Hanifa. And it's basically a collection of hadith. And this is a modern English translation, a modern English edition. And he actually obviously has his views on various rulings on how to live your life and so on. But it also mentions when Abu Yusuf and others disagreed with him, his direct students actually disagreed. So you can see Abu Hanifa said this, and then Abu Yusuf disagreed. The fact that he allowed that, or it was permissible, there was a certain kind of openness and a tolerance of diversity and disagreement amongst such. And Abu Yusuf, of course, went on to become a great scholar in his own right, as did the other student, whose name I can't remember how to pronounce.
Muhammad al-Hassan. He was the teacher of Imam Shafi'i. So, but one of the teachers. But also, like, you know, you mentioned the Pope. And yes. Isn't this, like, such a huge contrast? So Imam Abu Hanifa is not infallible. And he's teaching his students he's not infallible. And his students know that he's not infallible. And there's no, like, infallible authority anywhere enforcing any kind of position, but there's scholarship, and there's the best positions in a culture of learning and intelligence and inquiry and critique, they win out naturally. And so what you end up having is you end up having high quality scholarship.
If I can put this in a very kind of layman's terms, it just strikes me how very civilized all this is, you know. Religion apart, this kind of open discourse of presenting views and having disagreements, and you're not kind of condemned or anathematized or sent off to prison and to be tortured. It's very, very civilized and quite rare. I don't mean in the world, in the history of religions, is not normally, I think, what happens. Certainly not in the Christian Europe, where the slightest deviation from orthodoxy, be it Catholic or later, you know, Protestant orthodoxy, would land you in severe trouble. But here we have a tolerance of plurality of opinions and disagreements, which were kind of institutionalized by the great founders of these jurisprudential schools, Abu Hanifa, eponymously, of course.
So I think that I wanted to also talk a little bit about Abu Yusuf.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, you said that Abu Yusuf went on to become a judge for Harun al-Rashid, but this is very different from the way of his teacher, and it suggests Abu Hanifa didn't want to coddle up to power, he wanted independence, but his student, Abu Yusuf, actually became a judge. So how do we account for this apparent change in behavior?
So I want to show you a book. It's called Kitab al-Kharaj. It's written by Abu Yusuf, the student of Abu Hanifa. So Kharaj is a kind of taxation. So he's written Kitab al-Kharaj, the book of collecting a certain kind of tax. And he is, I'm going to read just a little part of the introduction, but he's telling Harun al-Rashid, the caliph, how he can and cannot collect taxes. So there's hadiths of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam that censure tax collectors. Tax collectors at this time are evil people, because you have the king's divine right of kings, and they need money. So they have their minions who go and knock on people's doors and say, give me a bunch of money. People say, no, if you don't, you're in the dungeons. And the tax collector gets a cut. So the more he takes, the more he... Yes. So they're like these like the evil people. And this is how taxation is happening. So in the time of the Prophet, this is kind of like a tangent, but it's extremely relevant that the only tax that was collected was zakat. And zakat was... And he wasn't allowed to take zakat. The Prophet wasn't allowed to take zakat. And it was... And when he would send people to the Bedouin tribes and when they became Muslim, telling them of zakat, he would tell them, it's taken from the rich among you and returned to the poor among you. So just the institution of zakat, it's just amazing, Sharia-wise, and when you look in the dark ages.
So what is if you have a very brief word, what is zakat for those who might not know? What why is it significant?
Yeah, so zakat is a pillar, one of the pillars of Islam, and it's an act of worship. And Islam is the only religion where almsgiving is an obligatory act of worship. So just as, so it's normally you think of worship as prostration, prayer, but one of the acts of worship that every Muslim has to do is they have to take 2.5% of their wealth every year and give it to the poor. And wow. And so in the time of the Prophet, this was collected and distributed at the state level. And efficient distribution, but he himself didn't take anything, wasn't permissible for him to take anything. And it was well-defined, and he would send people to collect zakat, and he would tell them, don't. So they would pay zakat in animals, because it was an ancient Arabian society, the most valuable wealth is camels. And so he would tell them, don't take the best camels, don't take the best sheep, but take like middle, average, moderate, and then it would be redistributed, and it was like the formation of a just society.
So a redistribution of wealth, basically, from the richest, yeah, to those who needed it most.
Yeah. So in the time of Abu Yusuf, in addition to zakat, there's other kinds of taxation, mostly on agricultural wealth, and Mesopotamia is like an agricultural powerhouse of the world, in between the two Tigris and Euphrates.
That's in modern day Iraq, of course, is where Mesopotamia is on the map. I mean,
and so it was very wealthy. In this time, if wealth isn't in terms of oil, but wealth is in terms of how much agricultural resources you control. So the Muslims in the time of Abu Yusuf, they are in control of this most fertile place in the world. Mm-hmm. And there was taxation that came to the government. And it goes back, there's justification from hadiths about the amounts and statements of the companions. But the important thing is that the caliph isn't sending tax collectors to arbitrarily take any amount of wealth that he wants them to take. But he is, there's a religious scholar, student of Abu Hanifa, and Abu Hanifa is a man of integrity. And so Abu Yusuf carries that integrity. And he writes an entire book to tell Harun al-Rashid how to and how not to collect taxes. So this is an introduction. And I just wanted to read some sections from the introduction. So at the top of this page, he says, "Hadha ma kataba bihi Abu Yusuf rahimahullah ila Amir al-Mu'minin Harun al-Rashid." So this is from a copyist later on. He's saying that this is what Abu Yusuf, may Allah have mercy on him, wrote to the leader of the Muslims, Harun al-Rashid. And so he prays for him. And then he says that the Amir al-Mu'mineen, he asked me to write a book for him that he could act on in collecting this kharaj tax. And And also on, there's some zakat is also in here in collecting all of this. And so this is very significant. So what Harun al-Rashid is saying, you tell me how I can and cannot collect taxes. And so he's telling him, and so he says that, and then in the third paragraph here, he said, "O Amir al-Mu'mineen, O leader of the believers, verily Allah and all praise is due to Him, has given you a tremendous position. Its reward is great, and its punishment, if you don't do it properly, is the worst of punishments. He has made you responsible for the Muslims, and you wake up in the morning and you go to sleep in the evening, and you Allah has made you responsible. He's going to ask you on the Day of Judgment about all of these people who are under your charge. He has entrusted them to you. He has made you their ruler, and he admonishes him. And he tells him to do good deeds and don't delay doing the good deeds of today to tomorrow. He tells him to pray, and he says, "It's just amazing." And this, he writes it, and it's published, and people all over the world and for the rest of human history, they copy this book, which begins in this way. And this second page is like the next page after this. It's just he's just admonishing him. And he's basically placing limits on what Harun al-Rashid can and cannot do, and this is publicized. Everybody knows about it. So Harun al-Rashid says, "Hey everybody, this is what Abu Yusuf told me to do." And everybody,
Harun al-Rashid was very different then from his predecessors. Clearly, so the situation had changed radically. Whereas Abu Hanifa, rightly perhaps, it was and wisely didn't get in with the powers that be. Here we with Harun, we had a very different ruler who was listening and wanting to fear God and to do the right thing.
Yeah, I mean there's some really good stories that are told about him. But I'm also like, so I admire him, Harun al-Rashid. I never want to be in his shoes, you know. But there's also, I think, and also that you should, it's good to have a little bit of healthy skepticism too, because at the end of the day, he does know that when he does this, he wins the favor of people. So, so there's going to be an element of that too. And inshallah, he was sincere and he's rewarded by God for doing the good things he did. Things were, his people who came after him, there were some problems with his sons. But it went up and down. But we had good, bad, I think the important thing to take away is that in this time when you have this independent body of lawmaking scholarship that is independent of the ruler, and it is people follow it, and the laws that they write are actually implemented in society. Mm-hmm. They are natural intermediaries between the masses of Muslims and the rulers, and rulers need to listen to them. They need to, and so it's like a check. It's a huge check on power. But what we have in the modern age is that with the decline in religiousness in Muslim countries, this whole institution, I don't like to call it institution because it's like independent, but this whole group of people, they basically disappear. And when they disappear, now Muslims, they become vulnerable to dictatorships and oppression, absolutist rule. And it's like, it's the loss. This is how when Muslim societies become less religious and Sharia is less important in the lives of people, they make themselves susceptible to being oppressed by, and then you have the modern state and modern technology, and that just adds to it.
Very depressing. So coming back to Abu Hanifa, so how exactly did we go from Abu Hanifa to the Hanafi school? The Hanafi school is the most widely followed jurisprudential legal school understanding of Sharia in the world today, and has been in many areas of the Muslim world. So how do we go from Abu Hanifa to the Hanafi school?
Yeah, so the school, the school, it was, it takes a while to develop. So what all of the schools, they, so you have, at this point, you have figures who are recognized as, for their scholarship, by a society that values religious knowledge and scholarship. So this means that only the best names will come to the top. And then you have their students, Abu Yusuf and Muhammad ibn Hassan and others as well. And then they have students, and then their students have students. And so there were other people like Abu Hanifa. But over over time, there were the four schools that are now known as the four schools. These are the schools whose students and students and students and students, it's a tradition that continued. The others, they died out. People sometimes give political reasons for it, but I think it's just a it's a description of quality. And so over time, when you have lots of people, lots of intelligent people studying and congregating and disputing and engaging, then the best scholarly accomplishments come to be recognized, and then a school develops. So around this, you have student. At every stage, there's critique, there's improvement, there's organization, and then you have summaries. So somebody comes, there's this huge, hundreds of people who have opinions within the school. It's, they agree, they disagree. And then somebody comes and they summarize it, and they say that if you want to study this way of deriving legal rulings, then start with this, start with the basics, and then do this, and then do this, and then do this, and then you'll come to a book like Kitab al-Athar that you were showing of Abu Hanifa, and that this becomes a school over the centuries.
And as a plurality of opinion, it's not like everyone has the same view. Right from the beginning, we have Abu Yusuf disagreeing, who's a disciple or companion or student of Abu Hanifa, disagreeing with his master. So you get the sense of plurality and diversity of views within a school.
Yeah.
Okay. So I've heard Muslims today say that Abu Hanifa was weak in hadith. What's going on there?
Well, you just held up a book of hadith, you know? So ascribe to him. Yeah, so Abu Hanifa, I think he was a very influential man, very intelligent man with many students. He solved many problems, and he was an original creative thinker. And from the earliest of times, there were people who, there were some scholars of hadith, Ibn Hibban is one of them, and some others who criticized him based on hadith, saying he was weak in hadith and didn't have knowledge. And it seems to go against some hadith that they knew. They didn't understand how he came to his conclusions. To come to a conclusion, you need a lot more than hadith. You need, there's a whole methodology of ijtihad that you need. So they weren't as qualified as him, but they were good in hadith. And so they made certain statements, and these statements came to be transmitted over the ages. They were, when the schools developed, nobody really paid attention to them. But in recent times, there's been, all of these old statements have kind of been dug up. And so to me, it's like, it seems, I think an example that I sometimes use is, if somebody comes and says to you that, well, this theory of relativity is a really crazy theory. It means that if you're going really fast, time will travel at a different speed for you than it does for a normal person. And so, how can you be so silly and and you know, don't use your mind and just reject this. And so we immediately, because of our regard for the authorities of science and physics and Einstein, we dismiss this. But what's happening here is that I think that we no longer have an appreciation for the scholarship of people like Abu Hanifa. And because of that, we become susceptible to being influenced by these kinds of objections. I would recommend somebody, they want to learn the Hanafi school and Hadith and how it works. I have a friend, a young British scholar, Sheikh Tabriz Azam. He runs Irshad.co.uk. And he teaches Hanafi studies there. I highly recommend that for everybody.
Oxford University in some way?
He has students from there, but he has his own independent institution where he teaches. Maybe I'll give you the link and you can put it in the...
Yeah, that's a good idea, actually, because I'm not familiar
with
his work, unfortunately. I'll put it in the description below so people can investigate that further. Hanafi scholar, I should say, in Britain, in today's world. So the tradition lives on, of course. So, well, thank you very much, Sheikh Hamza Karamali, for your time and your knowledge and expertise on this subject. Very interesting subject, very important. And I hope this will lead to greater interest in people to explore the works of the eponymous founder of the Hanafi school. And of course, there are three other schools as well. Let's not forget that came later as well. So thank you very much, sir.
Thank you for having me, Paul. Oh, it was a pleasure.
Until next time.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.